right, it's Liam. I want to thank everyone at the Oasis Podcast, as you were.
Welcome back to the Oasis Podcast, the ultimate audio guide to Oasis. I hope you guys are all right. Today's episode, we are going to be following up on last week. If you listened, we were talking about Oasis books. And I was joined by Richard, and we talked about all the various Oasis books that have been released. So if you haven't listened to that, go and give it a listen. But one of the things we discussed was the new book, Get on a Roller Coaster, Oasis in New Zealand. And I'm very pleased to say that I'm joined today by Kaz, who is the author of that book. So that is what we're going to be doing today, talking about that book and that crazy time of Oasis in New Zealand and other stuff. It was a good fun chat. News-wise, I suppose the only particularly interesting thing that's happening is that Noel Gallagher is currently touring. He started his sort of first leg of this sort of winter tour. He's over in Europe at the moment. He's done Paris and Amsterdam and Germany. Although the set list is exactly the same as it was, there's nothing new in the set list, which is disappointing. I was hoping we might get a couple of different ones, but no, it's all exactly the same. So we'll see. Sometimes these things change over time, and by the end of the tour when he's in the UK, it might be a little bit different. But as of today, no, nothing different. And I don't think anything particularly interesting has happened as well, although by the sounds of it, people that have gone along have really enjoyed it. And there was some interesting banter at one of the German gigs the other day, because there was a bunch of Geordies there. So, the Oasis Reunion account has spliced this together. So this was good fun.
Are you aware of what Geordie cunts are? It seems we have some in the house. Are you real Geordies? Mate, bye-bye. Is he a Geordie cunt? Do you know what? I reckon I could understand fucking German and I could better than I could understand you. Not a fucking clue. Put the lights on, let's have a look at these ugly cunts. Alright? One of those looks like a fucking farmer. You just sound like a lot of Geordies talking shit. No one. The Geordies booing people from Manchester. They still all dress like us. And they all want to be us. What are you singing? Oh, have you stopped now? Shy.
Me.
I can't understand a fucking word you're saying. I think you've been amazing. Not you, Geordie cunts, don't you fucking clap me. Like they dedicate this last song to the Newcastle United's doomed fucking trying to win the fucking Champions League. Oh, I'm throwing shit now, eh? Have a safe journey home. Good night. Good night, thank you very much. Good night. You Geordie cunts.
All right, well, look, let's crack on, shall we? Let's cross over to me and Kaz. Hello and welcome back to the Oasis Podcast. I'm very excited to be joined by Kaz Sahota. How are you doing?
I'm good, thanks. Thanks for having me on.
So thank you very much. I've got it in my hands. Obviously, this is an audio podcast. This doesn't mean anything to anyone listening. But you very kindly pinged me out a version of this before it got released. And it was just so nice. I mean, like, you know, I've talked about it, and the next episode coming out, you'll hear me and Richard, inspired by getting hold of this, actually did a sort of a an episode about the history of like Oasis books and what are the essential Oasis books and things. But this for me feels like a new chapter in the history of Oasis analysis, because up to now, like, every Oasis book has either been personal recollection or Google, right? And I don't think anyone has ever, and this has put me and Richard to shame as well, the level of depth here, you've got their visa applications. you've got the flights they came in on. Like, this is forensic. Seriously, this is crazy. This is exact, you know, this is setting the standard for, you're going to do a book about Oasis, you know, you can't just rely on Wikipedia anymore, boys. Get, you've got to follow Kaz's lead here.
No, thanks. No, I am. But see, I think when I set out as a fan, I say, I just want to know everything. And obviously, I don't know any of the band members. I'm just an outsider. So the chances of ever, you know, meeting Noel and Liam and asking him a few questions, virtually impossible. So I said, how can I relive or reenact this moment in their history, but also New Zealand history? And I thought, you know, there's obviously a lot of people who went. But then just the press, you know, they must think at the time, you know, what did the papers think and the magazine? So, I mean, I initially started with that. I'm an archivist, so doing research is, you know, kind of my bread and butter, digging into things and trying to find out information. So I kind of knew where I had to go. Yeah, so I knew where I had to go. So National Library in New Zealand holds publications, so that's pretty close to work. So I took a few days off work and just started digging. So I just, you know, the most I'd heard about this tour was from, you know, Forever the People, 6 months on the road with Pat Palahiut's book. So he references, you know, the drama in Wellington. And I thought, oh yeah, that's kind of the general memory of the tour here. Gets a few negative reviews in the press, and a couple of people I met didn't have much positive to say about it. But then I never heard anything about the Auckland gig, because that wasn't mentioned in Paolo's book. So initially just trying to find some reviews, trying to find some pictures. And then when I had a decent start finding some good press coverage, early reviews and interviews. And so then I started my widespread search and trying to find people who actually attended the gigs. Right. And that was an attack on multiple fronts. So Facebook, Twitter, classified ads in the paper, and then just word of mouth. Like, I knew someone who'd gone. So I was like, oh, who did you go with? You know, go and ask them, that kind of thing. And then it took probably January 2022. And by July, August, I must have had like at least 60, 70 people. And I thought, okay, this is more than I expected to find. And then piecing it together with the press. And then I got a few leads on some photographs. So then it's probably by Christmas last year, I was like, gosh, there's actually quite a lot of information here. What can I do with it? And how can I put it together? And then that's when I started asking a few people who published books for their help. And I just see, you know, what those next steps are. And obviously quite a lot of steps to get to where I am today. So it's taken most of 2023 to kind of actually nail it.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Well, it's a remarkable piece of work. I mean, just taking it back. So you didn't grow up in New Zealand then, or did you move over to New Zealand a little bit later in life?
Yes, late in life. So I was, as you can probably tell from my accent, from the Black Country, West Midlands.
Well, it's wavering. I was like trying to place it, to be honest, because it's like New Zealandy, and I was like, wait, is that Irish in there? Is that, you know, Black Country?
Okay. Well, I've lived in a few places. Lived in Liverpool as well, so, you know, there's, but mostly West Midlands, Wolverhampton. You know, home of Slade, you know, claim to fame. But so now I moved here about 13 years ago. So I was too young to go to either be here now to all myself. So first time I saw Oasis was 2005. And then saw them a couple of times on the Dig Out Your Soul tour. But yes, I came here 13 years ago. And, you know, there's huge bands here, like American bands, like Foo Fighters, like superstars here. But I was like, don't really see too much about Oasis here. And I was like, well, I wonder why. So, you know, I've Googled a few things and, you know, see the odd odd list where it lists the worst concerts in New Zealand history and the Wellington gig turns up. I was like, was it really that bad? I was like, they turned up, they performed, you know, they compared it to a Lou Reed gig, which where he never even turned up, or I think he left after 15 minutes. I'm like, they did most of the show. So no, it was later in life I came here, and then it was a matter of just personal interest, really. It's like, okay, what can I find out about this band in their one and only visit to New Zealand? Because that's the thing, they obviously are super A-list in England, and they did quite a few Australian tours, but they just never tagged on another New Zealand leg for whatever reason. I mean, it's a small market, and you know, it's only 5 million people here now. So by the time they came in 98, it's probably only got 3.5 million people. So it's a very small place. So I guess whatever impression they left, it goes a long way. So into kind of you know, in terms of their legacy here.
Yeah, I mean, I know that the a key thing that when I think about that part of the tour, it tends to be those images, and like there's, I think Michael Hart actually, you know, who I don't know if you know from Australia,
who's
been the show, and he's sort of, I think it's he's put it together like this compilation on YouTube of all the stuff when they came to Australia and all the Cathay Pacific stuff. I mean, that sort of, you know, this for me, I mean, just taking it back to where I was in March 1998, like, you just love him reading the enemy and finding out what they were up to and like where who they were up this week and stuff. And yeah, and so it was just that, you know, that was just obviously it was a crazy tour. It was sort of, you know, the tour had been going on for quite a few months. It was getting a bit fractious and there's a lot going on, as you know, as Paolo really brilliantly documents. But I mean, just taking it back, I mean, when did you like growing up in Wolverhampton, how did you first get into Oasis?
So it's kind of it's, I guess it's similar. I've got an older brother. He's 4 years older than me, so he's a massive fan. So I guess I followed his lead. So he was, I guess, old enough to kind of, you know, I think probably the Morning Glory era, he kind of got into him. So then by the time I'd Be Here Now, I just remember the release of Be Here Now is insane. So one of my, look, I guess you remember certain points in your life. I remember that, was it Thursday? Yeah, Thursday, school holidays, going down to Our Price to get the cassette at the time, and then me and my brother just listened to it the rest of the day when we got home. So it's kind of hooked by Be Here Now, and then yeah, just followed them as religiously as possible to the end. But yeah, just wasn't able to catch them until 2005.
Mm-hmm. And then was that in the UK then?
Yeah, so was that in Newcastle? So I saw them in the Newcastle Metro Arena. 2005, and then the Liverpool Echo Arena at the start of the Dig Out Your Soul tour. That was probably like second or third show of the tour, I think, and then Heaton Park towards the end. Luckily not the one where the generator failed, but one, okay. I think might have been the third show, it was okay.
Mm-hmm. But you didn't get your money back though, that's the thing, if you've been on the one where it broke.
Yeah, I know, a lot of people got those souvenir tickets, which are probably worth quite a bit now.
Probably get on the OCG.
Oasis back in Manchester in front of 70,000 fans. All was going well, but then this. The generator failed for a second time. Liam walked off, for once lost for words. You could sense the crowd were edgy, so organisers said sorry. After half an hour, though, the problem was fixed, and Noel and Liam returned with this message.
This is a free gig from now on. You'll be getting your money back.
Anybody who's kept their tickets will get a full refund, so we're going to start from where we are now. Thank you very, very much. This is a free gig. Let's have it.
Yes.
Cool. All right. Well, look, and then, so obviously, you know, it's been a part of your life ever since. But so, how did you? I mean, so you said it sort of started out just as a website, or just an idea for like a blog article, or how does this? What was the initial consideration?
Yeah. So initially, I didn't have much confidence that I would find people who went, because I was like, how am I going to find people from 25 years ago? having only known one person, who was a guy I worked with. So it's mainly just a personal interest at the beginning. So I want to find, you know, find some photographs, find some press material, and then the way I started was basically on Facebook. You got various regional groups. It's probably the same in the UK. Like here in New Zealand, like each town or city has their own like Facebook page. So like, you know, late lost nightlife of Wellington, or you know, and each suburb, or you know, or like, you know, live gigs that rock New Zealand. So I just did a couple of like teaser posters, like, does anyone remember the Oasis gig and anyone gone? And then I was like, oh, actually got quite a few people from those couple of posts. And then I just kept posting more. Then I just must have joined, I feels like, every Facebook group in New Zealand. So like each suburb in Wellington and Auckland has their own page. I joined those out of interest. I said, look, has anyone been to this concert? There's one in Auckland, one in Wellington. And obviously time changes, you know, 25 years later, I think I found people in Australia, in America, in France, Britain, like these, you know, Kiwis are known for going all over the world. So the 100 plus people I found were all from all over the place. Yeah, it's mainly through chatting to people on Facebook groups, and then very specialist groups like Vinyl Collectors New Zealand, because I thought, you know, obviously music interest. And then I think I found a couple through Twitter. And then I think you put me in touch with a couple as well, members of the Oasis podcast who follow you. So a couple of people found through there as well. But yeah, I think I must have found close to 200 people. And then I think I must have used 100 in the end, because I thought, you know, some say exactly the same thing as other people. So I was like, it's not really worth
saying the same thing again.
And then when I got that far, I was like, oh, I could just end it here and say, you know, they came, here's the recollections, and they left. But then I wanted to think about what impact they may have had on the New Zealand music scene. So then I tried to get in touch with various New Zealand musicians. And surprisingly, I think I must have approached about 30. Half of them came back and said, absolutely no interest and no influence whatsoever. But I've managed to get three who are fairly well known in New Zealand. One has a direct Oasis connection, which is the Sven from the Czechs, because the Czechs supported Oasis in 2005-06 on the Don't Believe the Truth tour in Australia. So he was an obvious contender, because I was like, you know, they always talk about Oasis, so that was easy.
I was going to say I'll have to get you to put me in touch with him, because that's one of the things I like to do, is get all of the, you know, all the people that have supported Oasis. And the Czechs is just one of those names I've seen on the list. The Czechs, okay, yeah. I'll have to look those up, and I've just never looked them up. So I was really interested when I was like flicking through that. I like that you've got those musicians and the influences on them. And I was like, wait, hold on. I was just sort of flicking through, and I'm like, he's mentioned. And then I went for a drink with Zach Starkey, and he was lovely. And I'm like, wait, let's go.
Yeah.
Part of this page.
Yeah.
Oh, shit.
Yeah.
Okay. The Czechs. Oh, yeah. I know that. Yeah.
Yeah, no, they're some great songs. I mean, they've disbanded now, but he's in another band called Racing. So there's a couple of members from the Czechs still in there. So now I just sent him a quick email, and he wrote this massive piece back. He said, I hope that's good enough. I was like, amazing. Like, you know, I didn't see people have been so generous with their time. So even the attendees who went, because I was like, I'm just a random guy asking for something from 25 years ago. So I was like, a lot of people probably don't remember it, but some people have a, you know, photographic memory, and they provided so much detail, but just the experience, like, you know, of the journey they made and how they got tickets. So it's like a snapshot of late 90s life, which isn't the same anymore. But no, they were so generous, and I mean, if it wasn't for the fans and their stories, I have nothing to say really.
Well, that's really interesting, because, and I think I was looking back at our messages on Twitter, and I think that was my only sort of concern I flagged with you, and I said this on the last episode to Richard, that, you know, when you're getting fan recollections, you know, a lot of them can be samey. You know, a lot of them can be, oh, it was amazing, or, you know, and it's, oh, I can't remember, you know, they started with Be Here Now, you know, and it's like, yeah, okay, but you give me the flavour here, and it's sort of it's something that I've had to contend with on the podcast and trying to keep it interesting, because if it is just people saying the same thing over and over again, then how do you keep that interesting? So I was really pleased. I know that I'd sort of said that on our messages, and I think that that's something that's really come through in here, is that, yeah, it is, you know, you've got some really, a really nice mixture. Some people that are just like, yeah, I saw them, I thought they were shit. You know, I didn't really like them. And, you know, to be honest, I've not been bothered about ever seeing them again, through to super fans. And you do get those little stories. And actually, that was probably, you know, I found myself really enjoying reading through those. And I'm someone that's heard probably more Oasis origin stories than anyone else in history.
Yes, absolutely.
I was like, oh, that's great. And I think it's just that different, you know, whether they're people that have, you know, like the one that was at Nebworth and then came over and saw them. I really like that one. And and there's just all these nice sort of variations of ages and experiences and stuff. And obviously coming from New Zealand, it's just a different, you know, most people that I speak to tend to be American or English or British. And so, yeah, so it just gives it that sort of slight change, doesn't it? And the anticipation, you know, having cancelled the tours and then. So I suppose that really does affect things and change things. It's that the way it physically came and having to wait for so long for them to come.
Yeah. And you mentioned that. I mean, I didn't know too much about the cancelled tours until I started researching. I mean, I knew about the 96 one, because that was on the back end of the cancelled US tour. I had no idea that they had planned to come out in 1995 as well. So there's little things I learned along the way, and then it's just trying to make sure, you know, everything was accurate and you know, make sure I had luck in. Try and find a press piece on the time to, you know, try and back up that, you know, the feeling at the time, because he as you see in the book, you know, the start off relatively unknown, and then as probably the same thing around the world, as soon as they hit Wonderwall, it's like they became global superstars, and then suddenly the press coverage goes insane, and it's all building up to this big moment in late 96, because all the Nebworth press comes into New Zealand, and then they announce they're going to come, and then they cancel that tour. And then there's a bit of a backlash, and then they kind of go kind of out of favour by the time they finally do make it in 98. But yeah, there's some people were amazing with the depth, and then I guess some had the close working relationship, because they had some people who were working on the posters for the various concerts. And so that's amazing. It's like, you know, those little details you don't, you know about how they put the posters together. And then there's a lady who was the event manager at the Wellington concert. She was amazing with the details she had about how, you know, just funny stories of, you know, Liam falling out of the van, like, you know, because he's, you know, a bit plastered, you know, just these little snippets. So I think as I went further along, it's like it is Oasis history, but to me, it's also New Zealand history, as in it's like a moment in time when, you know, one of the world's biggest bands came here. And it's like, what did that mean to people? What kind of mania did it generate? And so my idea was to try and capture that in one place, so that, you know, anyone in the future who's an Oasis fan in New Zealand, or just, you know, worldwide, who wants to find out about this tour, then it's all in one place, you know, from the press coverage and the photographs and the recollections.
Yeah, I mean, that was really the thing that blew me away when I first started reading it, was I'm like, shit. I've never read that. Like, I've never seen that. Like, all of these, as you're flicking through, it's like single reviews from like Supersonic in Rip It Up magazine in New Zealand in September 1994. And you're like, how have you got? I've never seen that. You know, like and then later on, you've got like, there's an interview with Gwigs. You know, you very rarely see an interview with Gwigs. And I'm like, I've never seen that. Like, I was thinking, I have to take a photo of that and ping that over to Mary, his sister, because she's probably never seen it, you know? Like, there is so much stuff. It's so rare, especially when you're an Oasis nerd like me or like we are, everyone listening. You know, we've read every article. If you Google, like, you've read everything, you know? Whereas then you've got, like, you know, you've just got so many things here that I've never read, I've never seen. I mean, so just talk to me about that, like that archive, being an archivist, sort of what the actual process is. I mean, I kind of imagine, like on like the microfilm, you know, when people in 80s films and they're like, you know, scrolling through, like you're normally trying to find a serial killer and they're like scrolling through, ah, oh, it was built on an Indian burial ground, you know, that is it. That,
yeah,
is it that?
Yeah, no, no, it was a bit like that. So I had, I had a list of key publications that I was targeting, and then from there it was, I mean, there were about four or five I knew of, like Ripper Up was a famous magazine, and then there's like a Real Groove, and then like I didn't know about Pavement at the time, because obviously not growing up in New Zealand, I hadn't seen a lot of these publications, so I basically, my approach was, I must have been like their favorite person, not really at the library, because at the National Library, because I must have said so many times, I want every single edition of this publication between 1994 and 1998. That's like every single one, and I must have looked through about 70 publications, and then there's like so you got the main newspapers like the New Zealand Herald in Auckland and the Midian and Evening Post in Wellington, but then I started going through all the regional papers like the Waikato Times, the Bay of Plenty Times, and then the Rotorua Daily Post, like all these regional papers. It's like, surely they must have had a story on them in that time. So that's how I found some of these Auckland gig reviews, because I guess the upper part of the North Island of New Zealand, it was a big deal. So, you know, people from Hamilton and Tauranga and Rotorua and Whangarei would have all travelled to Auckland for this concert. And then it looks like the papers also sent a reviewer along as well. So, yeah, it was... Some of it was microfilm, some of it was trawling through the physical papers themselves. And then some of it was by chance. Like, there's a publication there called Swerve. It only had 8 editions, the one in 1994, where they were on the cover and they had the interview with Noel. So it was a very short-lived publication. But in that time, they managed to get an interview with Noel, which had some great quotes in there. Some disparaging comments about other musicians, as per usual. But no, it did help knowing having done, you know, I do research as part of my day job, but that's mainly for other people. So they give me the topic. So finally having a chance to do research on something I like, I was like, I could do this all day. So that was the fun part. It's like, just sometimes you find snippets of information that wasn't even relevant to the topic, but you know, I guess other events at the same time. So like Michael Jackson came to Auckland in 1996. I was like, oh wow, like, I didn't know that, you know. And then there's like the build up to his concert was turning up, and then there was like other concerts that I think REM were touring with Crowded House. Like, man, that would have been a pretty good gig to go to. So like, you just, it's like me reliving the mid to late 90s, just, you know, going through these publications.
Yeah. I do. I love that. I mean, even, you know, Britpop Memories, you know, who's one of the best accounts to follow on Twitter, obviously, like when he just posts these, it's just from his personal collection, like Old Enemies and Melody Makers and like just the gig pages and things. And it's like, which would you have gone to see that week? You know, it's just amazing that, you know, like you'll get sort of someone really famous supporting someone, you know, in like, he's like, oh my God, they supported them in 94, you know, it is really, you know, it's really good fun, that sort of time capsule element of those things. I suppose like the main thing that that Oasis in New Zealand is known for is the fact that the Auckland gig pretty much went off without a hitch as far as we're aware. And there's no audio for the Auckland gig, is there, or that's ever been released or leaked?
No, never seen anything for that. I mean, there's a bootleg for Wellington, but I had never seen a picture of, I think there's one photograph in Paolo's book of a newspaper cutting. So that was the first lead I had, was the New Zealand Herald. But yeah, even just tracking down those photographs was like like through a lead of another lead. So I think I found a review in the magazine, and then it said, "Oh, it's a photograph of Liam." So then they had the name of the photographer, and then I was like, "How are we going to find this guy?" So then, the guy who was at the Herald at the time knew him, so I was like, "Oh, can you put me in touch with him?" And then we got a conversation going. And I was like, "Have you still got the negatives?" And he's like, "Yeah." I was like, "Oh," so I didn't have to pay to get them digitized. I was like, "Amazing!" I was like, "You still got this stuff?" But yeah, I mean, I feel like that's what I thought would be of interest to the fans is outside, even within New Zealand. It's like you may have seen this article once 25 years ago, but you're probably not going to remember it. No. And especially the people outside in New Zealand who won't have seen pretty much any of this because it's none of it's digitized yet. You know, in the future, you think, you know, a lot of these newspapers and magazines will all get digitized. But even just, I guess, piecing it together is the main bit because there's so much information out there, but it's like it saves the effort of having to search for all these multiple publications one by one because it's now done in one place.
I know, it's amazing. And I mean, I was sort of thinking like with that one that Gwiggs wrote, I'm like, I'm going to have to take a photo of that. I'm surprised, you know, these will soon, I'm sure, as soon as this book gets out there, this stuff is all then going to end up getting uploaded. But yeah, for the time being, it's really amazing to just have an archive of like all this stuff that currently isn't on the internet. I mean, how weird is that?
Yes.
But yeah, I suppose like when you then obviously, so they start off, they come over, they go to Auckland and it's relatively uneventful. But then it all kicks off a bit when they get to Wellington, right?
Yeah, so it seems like the wheels have fallen off the wagon when they got to Wellington. But I think the general gist of it was that it seems like Liam was drinking nonstop on this leg of the tour. So, I mean, there's various recollections. People just seem to, you know, they were chatting to him in the pub, playing noughts and crosses. I was like, what? Imagine that, like, super global rock and roll star sitting in the pub playing noughts and crosses. And it happened to be across the road from the venue. So then he just walks into the venue a bit legless. And then, as you'll see from the cover of the book, he's got his kazoo in his mouth. And I was like, what? And then from the bootleg, you can hear it. It's like the opening of Be Here Now. It's like it all kicks in, and then he sings the first verse, and then he starts blasting this kazoo into the microphone, and it sounds like a horn. So I never knew what it was until I'd seen the picture. I was like, what is this noise that he's making? I was like, oh, he's blowing that into the microphone. And obviously, I think eventually Noel must have just had enough, and then, you know, threw his guitar down, and the both had a bit of a set too. Behind the scenes, but I kind of felt sorry for Noel because you see some pictures in the book like the next day where he's signing a few autographs for the fans, like, he looks quite sad, and I was like, you know, he's just trying to hold it together towards the end of this crazy tour, and you know, he's got to put up with his brother's behaviour, and I guess he was doing all the press at the time as well. Probably links back to what went on in Australia, because obviously Liam's got those very infamous quotes from Australia, you know, where he'd rather walk and said various things about the Cathay Pacific crew. So I feel like Noel must have been on all the media duties because he's the one who talked to the radio station in New Zealand. He also did the MTV New Zealand interview. And those were two things that I could not find. So unless someone listening to this podcast has those, I feel like they're gone, and that's a shame as well. You know, being an archivist, I feel like this stuff isn't even that long ago, 25 years ago. Then I got in touch with the media company who now run the radio station, and they said, now we didn't archive the interviews from the 90s. So it's like not just Oasis, but it's like, think of all those massive bands that came here, REM, Pearl Jam, whoever. It's like they must have done interviews on the radio, and they've gone. And the MTV one was so frustrating because the film archive here, which is called Ngā Tāonga, Sound and Vision, they had every single episode of season 2 of Havoc, which is a show Noel appeared on, but apart from the one I wanted. And my theory is it was down to Video Plus, because I was looking at the TV guide and that show used to come out every Thursday. For whatever reason, the week Oasis came, that show came out on a Wednesday. And I was like, whoever must have been recording it must have got caught out by the change of day. And now it seems like that interview is lost forever, because that channel was so short-lived. So that it was like a New Zealand version of MTV, which is mostly the UK feed, but then they started adding more New Zealand shows.
Right.
Maybe a year and a half, 2 years that channel lasted. So it's quite iconic here having those moments saved. But yeah, unfortunately, the Noel Gallagher interview seems to be gone.
That's devastating, isn't it? It is. It's mad that you've got. Yeah, I mean, like, I was shocked. You know, like when there's audio from like the Beatles' first ever, yeah. Like at the fair or whatever, and you're like, how the hell is there audio for that? Like, I was in a band for 3 years. And there's hardly any audio of us, and that was in the late 90s, right? And yet there's this like randomly in a church in like 1958, and there's someone happens to be recording it. It's madness, but it is. I just think at some point, I mean, I know there's those YouTube channels. There's like one called Oasis Media Archive, I think, that are trying to just get everything up, and obviously it's not their content, so they can always be taken down. But yeah, it does feel like. It at some point in the future, hopefully all of this stuff will be archived. But yeah, for now, yeah, it is a mad time. But yeah, I mean, even to the point that sort of Wellington gig, you know, I don't think I even realised this until reading through, but, you know, they had a proper row on stage. Liam's doing his classic, you know, everyone always talks about like the ranting in, you know, the second night at Wembley. But, you know... It's like, nah, is everyone pulling this up? Whoever's coming here, I can't hear a fucking sound. And yous are great. God bless you all. Fucking hell, it costs a bit of money. Fucking hell, it's going to rape our bank accounts.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not that fucking hard, right? I'll pay myself to get some decent sound on this fucking stage, right? I got fucking money here, I'll pay for it. Not that fucking hard, is it?
Yeah. So I think that would have shocked a lot of people, because as you can tell from the recollections, you had a mix of like the diehards. And I think they probably weren't too surprised, because they're probably following each move and they've seen some erratic reviews and shows and on the other parts of the tour. But I guess if you're a part-time fan who bought a ticket along because, oh my God, Oasis are coming, I'll go and see them.
I saw REM last month. I'll go and see Oasis this month. Yeah, you expect
that kind of thing. So,
proper band.
So, whoa, you wouldn't have expected that. It's like, you think you're going to get like an amazing rock and roll show. I mean, even still, some people still loved it despite the antics. But it's like, yeah, I think that kind of was some people have said, you know, it was a turning point for their kind of legacy here, because... It, you know, they didn't leave a great impression.
Sounds fucking hard, right? I'll pay to get a decent sound on this fucking stage, man. I got fucking money here, man. I'll pay for it. It's not fucking hard, is it?
And I guess if you don't come back, it's like not a chance to kind of make up for it, or you know, leave a better impression of yourself. I mean, they seem to have made up for it in Australia, because you know they went back in 2002 and 2005, 2006, and they seem to have, you know, got a big following there. If you look at, you know, Lord Don't Slow Me Down, the documentary, they've got massive, you know, crowds at the venues there. But yeah, it's just a shame that they just never tagged on another visit down here.
Yeah, no, and then even to the point that they were like Liam was like potentially going to leave the band, you know, ending Oasis. I mean, because they didn't end up doing a encore that night. They were supposed to do Acquiesce Now and the Walrus, and you've got the set list showing. Acquiesce and the Walrus were supposed to be played, and they didn't play them. And then they had a drama backstage. Liam wanted a band meeting. Then they were going to meet up in the morning. But then I think by the morning, everything is sort of chilled out a little bit. And then they moved on to South America.
Yeah, thankfully so. You know, I guess in the heat of the moment, some things could have turned for the worse in terms of, you know, making terrible decisions. But I mean, it sounds like obviously that was just one point in terms of the tension between I guess the brothers. And mm-hmm. I mean, having a chat to the crew, so that was another thing aspect. It was like, you know, once had the press and the attendee recollections, and I was like, oh yeah, let's see if I can get any recollections from the crew. So I did. First person I spoke to was Paolo, so he was great. I guess he talked a little bit about what he discussed in his book, which was, you know, which I still think is the best first hand account, because he was there. He can't ever top that. But I guess my approach was just to offer some differences in opinion from what was reported in New Zealand, so generally negative recollections in New Zealand. So it's great to get some mix of opinion. But yeah, chatting to the crew, it's like, I just wanted to know everything, but, you know, what was their experience, just life on the road? You know, what if they had any memories of New Zealand? I think one of the crew members got a tattoo in Auckland. It's like, great, even little things like that. It's like, you know, just this kind of thing they did on the road. But Gareth Williams, amazing detail about the technical stuff they brought along, like the amps packages and all that. It's like, someday someone will want to know that. So I was like, it's great to have that, you know, noted. You know, people want to know, oh, what did they tour with? And he's got all that information in his head. He's very generous to share it. But also, yeah, Michael O'Connor was amazing. He was the production manager from about, I think, 97 to 2009, basically. So he had some stories about... Because one of the questions I got was, you know, in the UK arena tour, to be here now on just late 97, you know, like Earl's Court and G-Mex, they had the, you know, the clock and the phone... And all that all the stage props. And some people were like, oh, why didn't they have that in New Zealand? And then just talking to Michael, he explained that perfectly, because it all, so even though he talks beyond what happened in Australia and New Zealand, but it's the context which leads you to understanding why they didn't bring all that stuff in Australia and New Zealand, is because, you know, they had that French trucker strike. And they couldn't take the stuff to Spain, so they ended up doing a gig in Spain with using the local equipment. And then they're like, whoa, this is amazing. So we don't need to actually lug this stuff around. So when they got to America, Australia, Asia, and New Zealand in 98, it's like, we just use the local equipment, because we don't need to, you know, lug all this stuff around the world. So just little things like that. It answered questions that I was receiving from attendees, but also my own questions. Like, yeah, why did they not bring that iconic, you know, material on the stage props with them to other parts of the world? So yeah, there's little snippets you get from the crew interviews, which, you know, for me is an honor to speak to them, because I was like, these people don't have to talk to me. I'm, you know, just a random fan who wants to know everything about the band. And, you know, they were very, very generous with their time.
So yeah, I think it's, so then that was it. Like we were saying, then they were off, you know, once they'd done the Wellington gig, they were off they went to, you know, they didn't break up. They went off to South America, and the tour carried on. And then, and then we go into obviously the break, and then Standing on the Shoulder of Giants, and the guys leave. You know, the couple of band members leaving. So, I suppose this was one of those real kind of, you know, defining points. I mean, it's not the final point, but it's one of those one of those breaking points. You know, it's one of those the various final straws that then caused the band to end.
Yeah, I guess it wasn't just them, the band members as well, because
I guess obviously he had Bonehead and Griggs left soon after. But then I think the Wellington show was the last show for the, I'm trying to remember his exact position. The front of house sound engineer. So I guess that was strange for them as well, because that was, I guess, someone who'd worked with them for so long. So I guess the vibe from the couple of interviews I had with the crew, they thought it was just a strange feeling in general. So, oh God, this is the last show we're having with this guy. And then just how they had to quickly rearrange things to get someone else in for the rest of the tour. So there's a lot going on. I guess they didn't have time to stop and reflect, because I think I estimated they're probably in New Zealand for about 67 hours, because they landed about 2 o'clock in the morning on the Monday. And that very Monday, they had a concert in Auckland, and they travelled down on Tuesday to Wellington for their concert. And then must have been about 6 or 7 p.m. on the Wednesday to fly out. So not even 3 days in the country. So it's like, this is not a time to catch your breath, really. So you can see why things have probably stopped building up, because you just on the conveyor belt of, you know, in and out, flying in straight to the hotel to the concert, next concert, flying out. It's like, you know, it's a very big world tour in such a short space of time.
Mm.
Like they started what, September 1997, and must have finished in April 1998. And it's like they traveled everywhere in that time. And then a lot of the time, it was the first time they went to these countries, first time in Australia, first time South America, first time New Zealand. So there were superstars as well at that time. So I guess they're just getting mobs everywhere. There wasn't a time to, you know, have a moment to themselves.
Yeah. And they were in a bad way. You know, the drinking and the drugs were sort of at their peak. And so it's not like, you know, it's not, even when you get to like you say, the Lord Don't Slow Me Down documentary and stuff, you can just see there, you know, they've got Andy and Gem in the band. They're a bit more chill. You know, they haven't got, obviously, Bonehead's known to being a lunatic. And, you know, and you know, I suppose that first period of Oasis, they weren't like built rock stars. You know, I mean, Liam kind of became that. Noel became this sort of raconteur. But you know, Bonehead and Griggs, they're not cut out for it, you know, whereas once you get to Andy Bell and Gem, they were sort of seasoned hands, you know, and it was a bit more chill. Yeah. But yeah, I do sort of, you know, it's such a fascinating period. And like, I think, like, if someone did a film, you know, we've talked about that on the previous episodes, like if there was a biopic of Oasis, like, you know, I'd love to see a biopic, you know. I think if you do a biopic, it's like, well, do you start at, like, you know, and then they grew up in Manchester, and then you've got the dad beating them up, and then, you know, and you know, oh God, how many times you've seen that? Whereas I think like something like this, like 67 hours or whatever, 67 hours in New Zealand, and that just covers it, doesn't it? Because you've got all the madness of the gigs and the, you know, the being mobbed at the airports, and yeah, like, that'd be amazing.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I was... Because it's the era I grew up with as well, I've always been fascinated by this. I always wanted to dig deeper into the Be Here Now era. I mean, I love that era. I know people slate the album, but it's like probably my favourite album still. It's just amazing to me. But that is, there's so much history for that band that is just undiscovered. Mm. I was thinking, you know, if someone else could do this for another country, you know, obviously if I could speak more than English, I'd be tempted to do this somewhere else. But, you know, it took a lot of research, but it would require someone on the ground in a different country to do the same. I think just to have the access to the sources and knowing where to find people. But if someone had done this for, you know, the first visit to Chile or the first visit to Argentina, I'd be all over it. You know, I'd be like, I just want to know everything about them.
Yeah, no, I agree. And that's beautiful. Like I was saying, I think I said to you on message, like, I think one of the, like, a really interesting one would be like Japan and South Korea and those countries. Cause I mean, then you've got all the cultural differences as well. And the fact that those guys that in Japan always seem to be like, you know, the coolest people in the world, they're always first, aren't they? They always get, like, they're always, like, you know, the first place where Oasis got super mobbed and things like that. So Yeah, I think I'd love to do more with people from different countries. I suppose it's the language barrier, like you said. But yeah, anyone that's listening to this from South America who could, you know, could speak decent English, or from the Japan, South Korea, anywhere like that, I'd be fascinated to hear more about. And yeah, like you said, I'd love it if this became like the first step, you know, to lots more people doing this sort of work. Because didn't you base this, wasn't one of the original ideas, there's like a Beatles 8 days in Australia or whatever? Is that
was yeah, that 8 days a week. So there's a Beatles book. So it's 8 days a week. The Beatles toured New Zealand 1964. So I can't remember exactly how long they were here, but they went to quite Auckland, Christchurch, Wellington, Dunedin, and so on. So there's a guy who wrote a book, probably in the 2000s. It was after George Harrison had died, and he basically, the things he was there, so it was easy for him to kind of do that because it was his experience plus various fans, and he found some of the press and talk about the New Zealand releases and the family connections that John Lennon had to New Zealand, because I think his aunt or might have lived in New Zealand. So I read that book, I was like, oh man, and he kind of summed it up quite obviously Beatles on a different scale, but he kind of nailed it in terms of like the how big a deal it was. And so I know they're not the same and everyone always compares them, but I was like, for a brief moment in the 90s, for, you know, if I guess we were a teenager, it was like the equivalent thing. And I thought, obviously, you can't mention Oasis without mentioning the Beatles, and they get quite a few references in the book, because for some people, it was their moment. So Simon Sweetman, who did the foreword, he's a well-known New Zealand writer, so I think his foreword is brilliant. He sums it up beautifully. And yeah, I was like, you know, I think I was going to quote some of his words here. He goes, it was music that spoke to us, our Beatles or whatever. It was a moment in time. Mm-hmm. He goes, and to see that frozen here, held up not really for scrutiny, but held up entirely by and for love. Well, that's what music's about, isn't it? That's the very best thing about music. It brings us together, builds communities, even sitting in a bedroom or walking down the road now with our headphones on, or in the music of the moment, makes us feel less alone in this world. And I was like, when he provided that forward, I was like, I couldn't have provided a better introduction to this myself, because he had a look at what I'd done, and that was the impression he got. I was like, I couldn't thank him enough, because I was like, I could never have put that into words the way he did about what the tour meant to people, because he was there. He one of his reviews is mentioned in the book as well, but he's reviewed thousands of concerts and albums for the New Zealand press, so he's a well-known writer here.
Well, you know what, mate, I don't think we can that was brilliant. I don't think we can really top that, shall we? So let's leave it there, but thank you thank you very much for your time, and just like thank you for all the hard work you've done putting this together. Like I said, it's a crazy piece of work. Like, the level of depth and detail you've gone to is just, yeah, this is, like I said, it's setting a new bar, setting a new standard. Richard Bowes needs to up his game for the next I expect
I appreciate that. I mean, that's the thing. It is for the fans. I feel like this is the detail I want. As I expect other fans will probably want the same level of detail. So I try to leave nothing off the table, so I try and find as much as I can, because everything is of interest to some people.
Exactly. Yeah. It's like, is it worth keeping that? Yes, keep everything. We want everything, even if it seems like the most minor thing. But yeah, I love it. I love all of it. So no, really well done, mate. But yeah, where can people get hold of this? What's the best route?
So there's a couple of options. So for those in the UK, the best deal is probably it's called the Great British Bookshop. So if you just search Great British Bookshop and then just search for my name or the name of the book, so Get on the Roller Coaster or Karam Deep Sahota, you'll find it there. But it's also on Amazon globally, Waterstones online. Try my luck to try and get into a few stores in New Zealand. So it's a work in progress, but being an independent publisher, it's a bit hard to crack the independent shops here. But I've got a couple of leads, hopefully. But for those in Australia, New Zealand, Amazon Australia is probably the best outlet so far. But yeah, I've one thing I've been noticing is if I Google my name, I started seeing a few more links where it's available. So I don't actually know exactly where it's going to end up, but the main choices are probably Amazon, Waterstones, and Barnes & Noble in the USA.
Okay, fair enough. And Kindle edition or anything like that?
So I'm working on that. It's just because there's a lot of images. It's a bit of formatting involved. Yeah. So I'm hoping to get that out next year, probably. I'll have an ebook version next year for sure. I just don't know exactly when because, I just thought it was a case of converting my file into the EPUB files that you have on Amazon and Kindle, but it's a bit more work involved than that, unfortunately.
You didn't just copy and paste, no?
No. The things I've learned about publishing, I didn't think I would know a year ago is crazy. Paper types and embedded fonts and color schemes and everything. It's like, gosh, yeah, there's a lot to learn. And ebooks is a whole different game.
Oh, fair enough. All right, cool. Well, look, thank you very much for your time. As we often do when I remember to ask people, we'll finish with the Oasis song of your choice. Have you got a particular favorite Oasis song or something that means a lot to you?
My favourite song probably is Champagne Supernova, but I guess in going in line with the title of the book, I'd have to go Fading Out because, that's obviously, it was performed on the tour and Get on the Roller Coaster probably sums up that whole tour and whole era very well.
Brilliant. All right, well, look, we'll drop in a bit of that. But, Kaz, really great to talk, mate. All the best with the book and, yeah, speak to you soon.
Thanks a lot. Thanks for having me on.
So thank you very much to Kaz for that conversation. Really good to speak to him. As I said in there, very, very impressive piece of work. And I'm not just saying that because I got a free copy, although that does always help getting a free copy, to be honest. Fantastic work. And even if you're not from New Zealand, it's just really fascinating to dig so deep into these elements and see all these, as I say, unseen articles, unseen photographs. It's a real treasure trove of stuff. And like I said, in this sort of in this modern day, when most books, having gone through that kind of list last week or last episode, so many of them, the modern ones, you can tell it's just people have just written them based on Google and Wikipedia, and that's it. Whereas actually, to have gone that extra step, to have gone and really dug so deep, it's a really, really impressive piece of work. So well done, Kaz. And check out the link in the description. You can get it in the UK, I think, for like £14.50, which is really impressive because it's a chunky old book. So definitely worth checking out. All right, that will do it for today. There's nothing else particularly interesting to talk about, I don't think. One thing, I suppose, the not necessarily Oasis related, but if you came to our Alan McGee show back in 2019, The Water Rats in London, on the bill that night was a band called The Clockworks. So this was, October 2019? They'd only been together a few months. They hardly even had a set. It was, if you go back and listen to the episodes I did around that time, I talk about it, and it was amazing. They literally, bands these days that do encores and it's fake, what's going to happen, I haven't played their most famous song, and then they come back and it's a thing. Whereas this was genuinely like what an encore should be, which is that the crowd are really unhappy, you guys need to come back on and play more because they want more. And they didn't even really have any more songs. I think they only have 5 or 6 songs. So anyway, The Clockworks have then gone away. They've done loads of singles over the years. I've sort of kept a track of them, checked out all the singles when they've dropped. And finally, after 4 years of waiting, their debut album is finally out. And it's really good. It's really enjoyable. Some Britpop connections there, and it's produced by Bernard Butler. But it's a really interesting listen. I was really quite taken aback at first because a lot of it's like very calm and smooth, and his voice is sort of quite smooth. Whereas I remember seeing them live, and some of the early singles are sort of quite, you know, have really got that kind of edginess about them. And they've been compared, obviously, being kind of Irish. They've been compared to the Murder Capital and Fontaine's DC. And obviously they get compared to Arctic Monkeys because everyone in the last 15 years has been compared to Arctic Monkeys. But yeah, there's a real real mix of tracks, you know, from some really clean and melodic and emotional through to then the more aggressive ones that were sort of the more their earlier sound. So yeah, really enjoyed the album anyway. Anyway, not really Oasis, but Oasis podcast, because I've always look out for the bands that have done Oasis podcast nights. So really, really pleased to see them doing so well. I suppose the only other thing to say, you know, Masterplan re-release came out last week and it got to number 2 in the charts. So, yeah, very impressive. Shame we didn't get to number 1, but held off by Taylor Swift, which is fair enough. I suppose she's the biggest star in the world right now. So, yeah, very impressive, though, for a re-release with not much extra added to it. And yet it got to number 2 in the charts. There you go. That will do it for today. Thank you very much for listening. And most of all, thanks go to our patrons. You put your money where your mouth is. It's greatly appreciated. You can become a patron at patreon.com/oasispod, which is where we post bonus episodes, and you can become part of the Discord. And it's all just good fun over there. And you know you're supporting the greatest Oasis podcast in the world. All right, that'll do it. As ever, stay in touch, stay engaged, and stay young.
They won't carry you again until you give guarantees of some adult behaviour.
I don't give a flying what comes in it, because I'll tell you kids, I'd rather walk. But I meet that captain again with his top off and on the plane. See that? I've got a tattoo, mate, and I'll stab him.